The following interview is part of the Tales of the Trade series created by fellows in the Baltimore Youth Film Arts Program.
You begin by being really curious about the world and about worlds other than your own. I don't know about you, but whatever surrounded me in life wasn't that interesting. Or if I thought it was interesting, it was only because it was happening to me. And for me, being a journalist was the best chance I got to explore a larger universe than my own being. And so I came into every moment really curious about, you know, there were no stupid questions. That's probably what I would hinge it on, is there's no stupid questions. I was not a very good candidate for a job in the film industry. I wanted to be a journalist, a newspaperman, and I was for the first career that I had. And I sort of backed into film. I didn't go to film school. I couldn't tell one lens from another. I was a fan of film. I liked going to the theater. I consumed it like any ordinary civilian. The Baltimore Sun was bought by Out of Town Ownership from Chicago. Actually, first from L.A., and then Chicago bought L.A. So we were bought and then bought again by out-of-town people. And I looked upon Baltimore differently by then. I'd been at the paper for a decade, and I planned to stay here in Baltimore my whole life, being a reporter. I thought I might write some books. I might do some outside work, but I'm always going to come back to the paper and just be a reporter. And what I came to realize was that the people who had come into town from these out-of-town corporations, Baltimore for them was just a way station. They were going to come here, pick a few targets, try to win a Pulitzer Prize, take their prize, and get to a bigger paper. Those were the people running the Baltimore Sun. And I realized that what the city actually was or wasn't, what was true, what was not true, what was complicated, they had no interest in it. And by then, I had come to love it. And it's for all of its faults, for all of its struggles, I had great affection for Baltimore. And so the idea that it was just grist for their mill bothered me. And I left the newspaper. I was finishing the second book, which was The Corner, about a year on a drug corner. And I needed time to finish that book, so I thought, well, I'll do this TV thing, and it'll be a joke, but I'll learn a new skill set. So it ended up okay. But at the time, I remember standing out on that film set, not knowing anything, not knowing what the camera was for, not knowing what the sound guy did, not knowing that you had to turn the camera around and film it from the other side, not knowing how to talk to an actor. And I remember thinking, I've cut off my right arm. What I need to be is in a newsroom somewhere. I need to be in a newsroom with my feet up on the desk arguing with other reporters, because that's what I was trained to do, is to argue why this lead didn't work, why the coverage was bad, why we needed to improve this, why we needed to have a follow-up story on that. Those were the arguments I was capable of having, and I had walked away from that. And I felt like an orphan. It was a bad 6 months until I started getting the hang of the new world that I had signed up for. So even when I went to film, I didn't take it like it was a place that I would end up, and that I'd end up having a career. I think it was about 10 or 15 years of doing television where I finally admitted I wasn't going to go back to the newspaper. If not the Sun, then the Washington Post or the New York Times. Because I had an offer from the Washington Post, whenever you're ready, come work here. But again, I was sort of locked into Baltimore. And so I didn't do it, and I stayed. But man, those first 6 months, you want to talk about feeling like you were going downhill, I felt like I'd taken a wrong turn in life. As it turned out, what I thought was me quitting the paper and becoming an exile from the career I wanted was a good thing for me. I ended up having a film career or a television career. For an entire series, something that's going to last 3 or 4 or 5 years, even for a long miniseries, it's best to have a room of writers, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 different people, depending on the size of the piece and how many hours you have to write. Not only because it divides up the workload, but because if you've constructed the writer's room properly on a serial drama, and this is different, I think, than a feature film, but on a serial drama, especially if it's a political piece and it's set in the real world, something like Baltimore for The Wire, or New York for The Deuce, or New Orleans for Treme. These are large and varied places, and they have a lot of different people in them, you know, men, women, black, white, Latino, gay, straight. And the idea of conjuring different voices, all from one or two people, is much more problematic than having a whole room full of different people arguing. Argument makes story better. If I have a room where nobody's arguing in the beginning, or where people aren't shooting down the worst ideas organically, even if they're my ideas, like, you know, I mean, you have to open the room up to the idea of you don't know what's right until it's argued out. Argument makes everything better. And so you want to populate a room with different people. When we did Treme, for example, some of us were from Baltimore. But we were going to New Orleans, a completely different city that has inordinate amounts of cultural nuance. And I mean, the nuances in New Orleans have nuance. There's 15 different explanations of the word Creole, or of a Mardi Gras Indian phrase, Mita Kuta Fayo. There, you can get an argument over what it actually means. And to have the arguments happen makes the piece better. So the real process of where we know we're going happens in a room before you ever put film in the camera, before you ever hire actors. Maybe you've hired actors if it's season two, but in the beginning, it's just you trying to figure out, why are we here? What story are we trying to tell? And how many different voices do we need? And who in this room can take possession of those voices? We all like to believe as writers that we can write everybody. And to an extent, if you have a good ear, after other people have kicked in and made the characters all different and grounded them, then it's sort of easy to, yeah, okay, I can get into her voice. I can, because I've seen her now in four scenes. I'm starting to hear Candy Alexander's voice. So, okay, I got it now. But in the beginning, you want just a room full of different people to be arguing it out. And I've put a lot of belief in the room, the power of the room. Not everybody has to be the greatest TV writer either. Some of them are in the room because they just know the hell out of New Orleans, for example. Or in New York, they know New York. And as somebody from Baltimore doesn't. So if somebody in that room was in New York in the 1970s, they're very valuable, even if they're even if they might be a novice at writing television. I love them in the room because they'll steer us away from bullshit. But I wanted a homicide detective anywhere in the country, not just Baltimore, but Chicago or LA. If they worked murders, I wanted them to look at it and go, yeah, that's the job. I wanted to sell it to him. If I can make him believe that I know my business, I got a better chance of defeating imposter syndrome. Most writers will tell you, unless they're writing like their own autobiography, it follows all writers. It's there on your shoulder like a shit-talking devil who every time you put something on the page, you're going like, this is really good. And he's going like, how do you know? How do you know? And it doesn't go away just because you execute. Like a bunch of people might review it and say it's great. How do you know? That said, we are in a time where the very fundamentals that we claim to believe in, we've obviously never practiced it in any coherent and consistent way, or we'd be a better society than we are. But a lot of things we claim to be our best, the better angels of our nature, our best aspirations as a society, are really being challenged. And our institutions are lacking in responding to this new form of rhetoric that has elected this particular administration and is doing this kind of damage. And I just feel like if you're silent now, if you don't speak to it directly and bluntly, you're complicit. You'll be, you know, I want to mark down everybody who got quiet when this happened to us, when not just Trump, but the rise of nationalism and white supremacy and the denigration of democratic norms or our best impulses towards democratic government, even if they were imperfect. You either speak to it, or if you're silent, I think you will be judged later on. So I don't mind being blunt on Twitter, but the place where I'm really having the opportunity to say what I think about what's happening to us is Plot Against America, the next piece out, which is out in March. Philip Roth's novel is an allegory for what happens when you give yourself over to demagoguery and to false populism. And when you indulge in any form of intolerance. And in some respects, I don't know what it would be like to be a writer and not address on some level with your work what's happening to us right now. You know, when Roth wrote the novel, he was angry at George W. Bush for the war in Iraq. And the piece reflects his view of what was happening to the American government then. But you read that novel back, it's now 16 years old. And it really speaks to this moment. And so I feel like, I feel like I'm getting my 2 cents in. I'd hate to live through this time and you look back on, what did you say when the shit was on? And it's like, oh, I made an entertainment, I made an entertaining show. It's like either speak now or never be heard from. That's my feeling.